Sam Jones, thank you so much for being on the podcast tonight.
Thank you for having me, Max. I'm excited to look and looking forward to our conversation, what we're going to be talking about. So yeah, thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you're pastor of Abundant Life there in Humboldt, and you also are a outspoken abolitionist and very much into the movement of protecting life here in the state. And I'm pretty sure you've done, I think I saw that you were on that abolitionist conference. Is that correct?
Yeah. I had the privilege to speak there for both the Abolitionist Rising conference and for the End Abortion Iowa conference. I had that privilege.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. That's great. So I'd like to begin by asking you, what's the difference between abolitionists, and I know there's been a lot of conversation between abolitionists and the pro-life broader movement. So what's that difference between abolitionism and pro-life?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And it's one that comes up, and I think it's a distinction that needs to be made, because a lot of times people just kind of try to lump these two things together, maybe saying that, you know, abolitionism is really just pro-life 2.0 or the 100% pro-lifers. But I really think it's two distinct paradigms. And the first and most noticeable difference is that abolitionists, they are, they believe in immediatism. So, the concept of saying, you know what, we're not going to go for an incremental law. So we would reject, heartbeat bills or 20-week bans or, whatever the gestational point is that, that's being made. We would go and say, no, abortion's murder, and we need to make sure that our laws reflect that, in order to have just laws. And then the second one that really is probably the biggest thing that comes up, that people notice right away is that we don't, in our laws, we don't write out special murder privileges for mothers when they go and do this. And we'll probably get into this a little bit more later, but a pro-life bill most of the time will go and say that the pregnant woman is immune and impune, or has impunity and immunity from any legal ramification. And so that causes all kinds of problems. And I don't think that actually, it certainly doesn't abolish abortion. And I think that it establishes unjust laws with that. But some other broader points that are different is that when it comes to pro-life, you could be a secular pro-life view. You have a secular pro-life viewpoint. For abolitionists, it's distinctly a Christian viewpoint. We believe that we must be gospel-centered. Abortion is a sin problem, and so we need to fight that sin problem with the gospel. We believe that it's only through the church that abortion is going to be abolished. That doesn't mean that there's not a political aspect to it, of course, but it means that it's going to be the people of God who are doing that work. And you know, we trust in providence as opposed to pragmatism. We're not seeking to be the most clever in the room. We're seeking to be the most obedient to God in the room. And so I really think that these are based on two different foundations, and they have not just two different strategies, but ultimately I think it's really two different theologies, when it comes to abolitionism and pro-life, the pro-life movement.
Okay. Yeah. So why would, you'd mentioned something, in your comments there about the pro-life bills explicitly carving out or having language to give, the legal protection for the mother, and like explicitly says that. Why would the pro-life movement give that exemption?
Yeah, so there's kind of two sides to the pro-life movement as to why they give that exemption. The first one is the second victim narrative. So they've really spent a lot of time proclaiming and believing that basically the mother is a second victim. And they'll go and point out cultural pressure. They'll maybe point out coercion and duress and things of that nature. But the issue a lot of times there is that when we're looking at a bill and you use that word victim, it actually has a legal definition. And the woman, like, if the woman was a victim, well, certainly then specifically of the crime, then she shouldn't be, then she should be exempt from that. She'd be the one having the crime against her. But she's the one actually most of the time committing the crime in this is the problem. The second reason is really pragmatism. They say, we wouldn't be able to actually pass this. I've had pro-lifers tell me, you know, I'm where you're at, or I want to be where you're at, in a sense of the goal of actually truly abolishing abortion, but we can't get that passed. And so it becomes a pragmatic idea. But I would say the biggest reason is that second victim narrative. Like, I'm trying to think, I think it was 2022. It was after the Louisiana bill, an abolitionist bill came to the floor, and there were 70 national and state pro-life groups that wrote a letter and signed to it. Pulse Life Iowa and Iowa Right to Life are two of them that signed to it. And they said that they would never publicly support a bill that would criminalize the woman. And that's because of that second victim narrative.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, because I definitely think you'd mentioned the legal aspect of it. And I think there's a lot of truth in that of whenever we start talking about the victim, there's legal implications. I know that there's been several pro-life people that I've talked to that says, hey, you know, the mom's been lied to, the mom's been coerced, you know, for many different reasons. She's a victim also of that circumstance. And I just found it interesting. I was doing some research and stuff recently, and I think it's less than 1% of abortions that have taken place that there's actual like physical coercion. I get that there's social coercion, you know, and quote unquote with financial, you know, they can't afford to have a baby, so they're a victim, or they're not ready to have a baby. They don't maybe have the property, the housing, whatever. But like the physical coercion of say like the boyfriend or the husband forcing the lady to get an abortion, that's only like 1%. And additionally, I'm pretty sure, and I could be wrong on this one, but I'm pretty sure that every state has laws against coercing or soliciting illegal acts. And even with abortion, I don't think they can legally force somebody to go get an abortion, because at that point you're violating the human rights of that individual too. So I don't understand in that sense why there would be a special exemption for the mother to say, like, we will not prosecute under any circumstance, whether coerced or not. I don't understand why they would specifically put that in there.
Yeah, you know, Max, I really don't necessarily understand it either. I just kind of have to take them by their word when they talk about it, because they go and say things like the pro-life movement is a pro-woman movement. In fact, I would say that it's very much in broad scope that the pro-life movement is very, very much filled with feminism, and it's very much a feminist movement. This is why, you know, it's Abby Johnson, it's Kristen Hawkins. It's a lot of women empowerment that's right there leading in the forefront. Now, I'm sure that they would come back and say, well, the abolition movement, they're misogynist or something like that. You know, I'm sure that they'd come back and say something like that, but I'm just observing what they're saying. And they're coming out and saying that it's pro women. You know, the frustrating thing that comes to it is I just look at that situation and I'm going, okay, you're saying the woman is a victim too. Well, in an abortion, and granted, I understand that, yes, there is risks to an abortion. So I'm not saying, and I think there should be risks to murdering a child, right? Or murdering anybody. Like, it shouldn't be a safe thing. But they come out and they say stuff like, the woman is a victim. And I'm going, well, but the real victim is the one who actually died, is the one who actually was murdered. And that's the primary victim. And if we took this and we put it onto something else, it wouldn't make much sense. So, I've got a friend who, he's a former homosexual. He's gotten saved, you know, repented of this, but he recounts the story of the first time that he goes into a gay bar, and he's, you know, commiserating with people. And he goes and he says, you know, he was victimized as a child. He was sexually assaulted as a child. And somebody made the joke of like, yeah, and so has everybody else that's in this bar, because of course there's extremely high rates of sexual abuse within the homosexual community. And the problem is we would go and look at something like that, we wouldn't say, oh, because somebody was victimized, even though it was, you know, they were actually under the legal scope victimized. We wouldn't go and say they have immunity and impunity from committing another crime. They couldn't go and be a pedophile,
right?
And do something like that. And us go, oh, well, they were victimized, so it's okay. We need to carve out a thing in the law. Everybody would look at us like our brains had fallen out. And so I probably look at pro-lifers like their brains have fallen out when they talk about the second victim narrative. And then they get mad at me and I'm going, but let's just reason once for a little bit, you know?
Yeah. If we use that logic. So, I was talking to my wife about this and, you know, there's that level of saying, hey, speeding is wrong, of course. But if I'm speeding to the hospital to save somebody's life, you know, I've got somebody in the car next to, or in the seat next to me, that's about to die. And I'm speeding, at that point, there are extenuating circumstances in which I can go ahead and speed to the hospital, and nobody in their right mind would say, yeah, prosecute that guy. So in that sense, if you just take that example and put it onto this abortion case, say somebody solicits that abortion, and they force a woman to go through with an abortion, there would be that circumstantial, or prosecutorial discretion to say, hey, that woman was not a victim, or excuse me, she was a victim of this crime. There's a different crime there. So we're not going to prosecute her for being forced to get an abortion. You know, somebody put her arm behind her back and forced her to get that abortion. We're not going to prosecute her for that. But it's interesting to me whenever they specifically say, we will not prosecute totally because of an exception, because the pro-life movement has told us forever that, you know, with rape, incest, and the life of the mother, you don't want to give those exemptions, because if you said that we will have abortions in the case of rape, well, then rape accusations would likely go up, because if that's the only way that they can get an abortion, well, there, you know, people are going to find their loopholes. And so we've been told for all of our life, well, we don't want to give those exemptions. But then now it seems that they're given their own exemptions to say, well, we're not going to prosecute because of some edge case. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's interesting on that, like the coercion or duress thing, when you're looking at that, because there's a difference between physical coercion or physical duress and social duress, I guess you'd say too, because literally, physical duress, literally somebody who's being held down and they're forced to have an abortion. Of course, the woman is not doing anything wrong in that aspect. Just heard a story, was talking to a young lady who told me that, you know, when she was 13 years old, she was given abortion pills and she didn't know what they were. And it was from, it was a school administrator who was the one who had impregnated her. You know, this was a horrible situation. Yep. And I'm sitting here going like, I don't think that would probably be something that a judge would go and say this, because you're literally unknowingly doing this.
Right.
But even in like social coercion or social duress, that kind of a thing, there's in Iowa specifically, there's actually, there would be no defense of coercion for murder in that sense. And so it's even one of those things where sometimes I think that they try to throw out a coercion argument and it's like, well, you know, what's going to end up happening is that the woman's going to come back and say, well, I felt the pressure to go and get an abortion. Well, that should be prosecuted, but a good legal system is going to write the law exactly as what it should say. And the judges are going to come in and they're going to see, well, what are the circumstances around this? And that's how it should be with everything. You know, like you're saying, with different circumstances and whatnot, because we do have, you know, when it comes to murder, there's first degree murder, there's second degree murder, there's manslaughter, there's all of these things, but those are on the judicial side, not on the legislative side. And I think that's important for people to understand.
Yes. Yes. And you made a very valid point that the law shouldn't differentiate and try to give all the exemptions. It should rather say, hey, this is what's right and wrong. And then from there, once it decides what's right and wrong, give it over to the courts. You know, we do that with every other law under the book. You know, it's like murder's wrong. And then we give the ability for the courts to decide, you know, which level, which degree of murder, you know, hey, stealing is wrong. All right. Now we also have the ability to make it a felony, you know, depending on the level of it. and we give the courts the prosecutorial discretion to do that. So it's interesting that what you're saying regarding the pro-life movement specifically carving that piece out, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Right. Yeah, it does. It doesn't to me either.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we had two bills this past session, that were what I would consider the life at conception bills, House File 2332 and House File 2316. I know that the abolitionist signed on to 2316, and then the pro-life movement jumped onto the 2332, and then subsequently that one was killed. What was the difference between those two bills?
Yeah, so this is really a good way to see kind of the difference between the pro-life movement and the abolitionist movement. So 2316, which was filed by Representative Zach Deacon there in the House, a companion bill was also filed over in the Senate. It never received numbers, but by Senator Kevin Allons. And 2316, it was, it was abortion is murder, and so you ought to treat it as murder. And it was right there, from conception. There's no exceptions. There's no, there's no one who's exempt or anything like that. It is simply, it's treated as murder. And and of course, that's what abortion is. It's murder. The interesting thing is, of course, is that the pro-life movement and the abolitionist movement would both come out and say that phrase. But 2332 was filed by Representative John Dunwell, and he also went and ended up was the one who pulled it off of the subcommittee as well. But the big difference here is that his bill did have that immunity and impunity for the mother, and so there would be under no circumstance would a mother be able to be charged with murder or for an abortion or anything that would be less, whether manslaughter or anything. It gives complete protection and coverage over that. And that bill, the interesting thing is that type of a bill or similar ones have actually been passed around the state or around different states. Texas is one of them. I believe Oklahoma has this as well. I'm trying to think, there's some that are deep down south. A lot of them had with the Roe versus Wade, after that was overturned, they came up with trigger laws and things like that. But what we found is that abortion hasn't ended there. It hasn't been abolished. In fact, the sad thing is that actually, like in Texas, I think it was about 3,000 abortions were happening per month, which is about what we have in Iowa per wow. year. But of course, Texas is much bigger. That was, pre-Roe. And then post-Roe, it's actually risen all the way up over 4,000 per month. And that's about halfway through 2025. And I think one of the big issues and one of the big differences is that when you're not truly establishing justice, when you're not truly doing it God's way, well, then you're not going to get God's results. And that doesn't mean that there would be zero abortions if there's an abolition bill.
Right.
That's not what that means. Because
goes back to what your statement earlier, that the church needs to jump in, and it's really a revival at that point that happens. So,
yeah, absolutely. And murder happens, every day. But I imagine that it is less because there are consequences for murder. And what ultimately the problem is what incremental bills do. And in even like Dunwell's Life of the Conception Bill 2332, even though it has, life at conception, what it does is it teaches our culture that there are things that are actually okay that are not okay. So like a heartbeat bill, it's not just saying you can't murder a child after a heartbeat, but it's also implicitly saying you can murder a child before a heartbeat. And the really crazy thing with all the pro-life bills, but I'll specifically point out the 2332, is that you could actually have a second trimester or a third trimester abortion if you're the mother and you're the one who's committing it, and there would be no repercussions. So you could actually, a mother could go and order abortion pills, get the abortion pills, go and take them on the steps of the state capitol there in Des Moines under John Dunwell's bill, take them and murder her child right then and there, obviously it takes a little bit of time, so it wouldn't necessarily be, you know, exactly right then and there. But she could literally use the mechanism, take the poison to kill her child, and say, I am killing my child with intent and malice aforethought, which is, you know, the definition of murder. Go and take those pills. She could do that. And under John Dunwell's bill, she would be protected.
Because there's that specific carve out. Wow. So you had mentioned the incrementalism teaching certain things and such. So I've got a question, because this is one of the scenarios or one of the things that honestly I don't understand about the abolitionist perspective from the biblical side. So I know that the verse Isaiah, what is it? Isaiah 10, 1 through 4.
Yep, 10, talks 1 and about, 2. Yeah.
Yeah. Talks about woe unto you who essentially prescribe unrighteous laws. And that has been used, and I've heard many abolitionists talk about that. But the question that I have is that how do they justify incremental abortion laws like the heartbeat bill that we had in Iowa, when that verse seems to condemn more laws that promote evil, and the heartbeat bill is seeking to and other bills, you know, if it's going in the right direction, that is, seeks to restrain that evil. The reason I ask that is because abortion's legal. So to say to restrain that evil is not necessarily codifying that abortion is legal, given that abortion is already legal. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's interesting, because the one that you bring up, the heartbeat bill, that was actually really instrumental for me, because in 2018, the first time we passed the heartbeat bill, and I mean, when I sit back and I think about what we passed and the circumstances of what was going on in 2018, it's kind of wild that, you know, we thought this was a big win, because just a few circumstances. One, you know, it's a heartbeat bill. But then two, there was no criminal penalties. The worst thing that could happen is that a doctor could lose their license. There were all the exceptions, and the way that the doctor would lose their license was to go up to the Iowa Board of Medicine, which at the time, the chair of the Iowa Board of Medicine, literally somebody who used to sit on the board at Planned Parenthood at that time. And so, I mean, I'm going like, yeah.
So they're not losing their license, basically.
They're not losing their license. Yeah. Now, of course, it got suspended in court, and so it wasn't the law anyway, and all of that. But in 2018, I actually wrote an article. I was a pro-lifer at the time, and I wrote an article, and I was like, the heartbeat bill is great. It's wonderful. But it's just a start. You know, I did that kind of an article. And then there was an abolitionist, by the name of Tom Hoefling, who came on there. And I mean, he eviscerated my arguments. I mean, just eviscerated my article, and told me how terrible it was. And I mean, you know, I got back and I shot off something smart alecky back to him. And I thought, you know, I got him. And
I won.
I won. And then the problem was that as I was going along, I was realizing that logically I started thinking through his arguments, and I couldn't quite defeat his argument, because his argument essentially went like this. You're supporting a bill that's saying that it is okay to murder a child that doesn't have a heartbeat. That it is okay to murder a child, and, you know, in this bill's framework, that was conceived in rape. That it is okay to murder a child that can do this, because a law, when we look at it, it's actually making positive claims. It's not just saying thou shalt not kill, but when it's saying thou shalt not murder or thou shalt not commit adultery or something like that, it's actually giving us liberty. There's more liberty in that negative command than in the positive command. And so then we look at those negative commands. So thou shalt not murder. Well, what is that telling me? Well, if I can't murder, that means somebody else can't murder me. And that means I then have a positive liberty to life. I have that liberty to live. If somebody says thou shalt not steal, you know, if that's the law, then it's not just restraining someone else from doing something. It's actually telling me in inferring to me that I have the right to actually own property. It's not the state that owns my property or somebody else, but I actually can own that property. And so when it says you can't kill a child after a heartbeat is detected, it's actually giving us the liberty then to kill a child when the heartbeat isn't detected. And so that's what makes it an iniquitous decree, is because it's actually giving the liberty to do something that's evil. Does that kind of make sense?
It does make sense. And I see what you're saying regarding the positive laws, or the every negative has a positive counterpart. If you say that you can't steal, well, I can live in freedom without having my stuff stolen. And if I do have it stolen, you know, there's legal consequences. But at the same time, the part that doesn't, that I'm trying to wrap my mind around, is if it's legal, if it's fully legal. So we have, you know, when Roe is law of the land, fully legal abortions. And really it was, you know, if a state wanted to have partial birth abortions, they could do that. And so it's fully legal. So if a law restrains that evil, I don't, as long as it's in the right trajectory. So like, say, if we have, if abortion is fully illegal and we said, all right, we're going to give 6 week abortion or 6 week, abortion ban. So you can murder your child in between, you know, conception and 6 weeks, because of the trajectory of where it's going, I would say that's absolutely evil. Obviously. And I think we've got complete agreement on that one. It's just, I'm trying to understand, because as I see it, those laws that are trying to restrict abortion when it's fully legal, and trying to restrict that, I don't understand how that's necessarily an unrighteous decree.
Yeah. So, cause I would say they're not actually trying to restrict the evil. They're trying to regulate the evil, because the evil itself is murdering a child, inside the womb. You know, that's what it is. Or we could just say murder, you know, if we really wanted to look at it, because there's no difference. And so they're not actually restricting, murder. They're just regulating murder. And so it's not that they're saying, you can't murder a child. They're not saying you can't murder a child in the womb or you can't murder someone. They're just saying this is when you can do it. And so I would look at it and say it's different than, they're not even putting out a positive. They're just trying to tell you when you can't do a negative necessarily. And I think that in and of itself is evil, but then I also think it becomes really difficult, to what it teaches our culture. And this comes right back to a difference between pro-life and abolitionists. So in a pro-lifer, a lot of their rhetoric and a lot of their arguments when talking to a pro-choicer is that they're going to say things like, at 6 weeks, a fetal heartbeat is detected. At 13 weeks or 14 weeks, a child inside the womb can respond to music. At, I can't remember if it's 18 or 20 weeks, they can feel pain. And all of these things. And if you look at those, they're all different regulation points. And so they're trying to go in to say this. And their arguments become biological. Now, I don't mind pointing out biological facts. You know, I just did. Certainly I agree with, you know, this biological facts, assuming I got them correct there on the scale. You know, somebody wants to pop up and be like, actually it was 13 weeks. that's fine. But the problem is that biology never imputes worth. It can only observe what's happening.
That's true. Yeah.
And so ultimately I think the abortion question, when it comes to, you're talking to a pro-choicer, you're talking about what the law should be. The question is what gives that child value? And an abolitionist would say 100 times out of 100, it's the image of God, that the child is made in the image of God, and we can't murder anyone who's made in the image of God, no matter at what time. And that's where we have to draw the line. And anything short of that line becomes an iniquitous decree, because it's denying the image of God in that child.
That makes sense. That makes sense. So let me, I want to play a little bit of a hypotheticals, because we've, you know, I've listened to debates online and such where it's, hey, if you were a legislature, you were the governor and this bill came before your desk, you know, that sort of thing. So I want to kind of play a little bit of that, and see, trying to understand the logic of it. So say there's somebody that supports 2316, sponsors it. They say, this is the bill that I want. And then 2332 comes up and it goes through subcommittee, hypothetically, because it obviously didn't, goes through subcommittee, goes to the floor. And do they vote against that bill because they supported the abolitionist bill? So are they, in that sense, are they siding with the pro-choicers, or are they just abstaining from a vote, or are they voting for it?
Yeah. So there have been, so I'll answer for myself, and I'll give a couple of history of kind of what abolitionist legislators have done in that, in that sense, in that case. So me personally, I wouldn't vote for it. I would try to amend it, is what I would do, you know, in that situation. But you know, assuming I can't amend it, it's already double barreled or something like that. I would vote against it, is what I would do, because I do think that it's setting an iniquitous precedent, an iniquitous decree. And so I would vote against it. Representative Zach Deacon in our state, that's what he did with the Harpy bill. That's what he would have done, I believe, if 2332 would have come up. You know, obviously, I don't want to speak for him, but I'm pretty confident that's what he would have done. And then, just his name just left me. There's a legislator down in Texas, David Lowe, and I believe there's another one who did this. Sorry, I can't remember who the other legislator was, so I'm not trying to you know, hang them out to dry.
Oh, you're good.
Down in Texas, but there was I can't remember exactly what the bill was that came up, but it had to be pretty tight because it was, you know, it was tightening the reins on where it was. It actually might have been something very similar to 2332 there in Texas. And David Lowe voted, they have like three options there. It's different than the Iowa voting system.
Really?
But there's a yes, no, and then there's like a, I think it was like a white one. And the reason that he did that was because it was like, it's like this middle ground kind of a thing. But the reason he did it wasn't because he was in favor of the bill. It was because it gave him an opportunity to speak for the bill on that. And so then he was able to go in to talk about that. And there was some debate as to whether or not that was the right thing. I don't know if he would do that again. But I do think it's an interesting opportunity to be able to actually speak to something. And so I think that's, in my mind, I don't think that was necessarily wrong. Once again, I would have voted no, but I do understand that concept of voting in such a way that you could speak.
So then, with that, with the vote to on the no side, it's not just an abstaining from a vote. It's explicitly stating, no, I do not support this this bill going forward. To me, that kind of sounds like I can't morally support Donald Trump, therefore I'm going to vote Kamala Harris. Does that make sense? Because it's like, I don't know. It's one of those tricky scenarios that I think that, you know, we can sit here and like point fingers at who's right and who's wrong and such. And not that we're doing that, but like,
No. So the reason though, I would do it is one, yes, principle, but I do think the principle works out in the practice. So since Roe versus Wade has been overturned, and I'm sure you know this, that every year abortion numbers in America have gone up. We're up to 1.2 million. And then also like looking at this, I would say, you know, specifically in the scenario too, although I would do it, you know, even if it didn't have, I guess if it didn't have the exception there for the mother, that it would basically be it'd be 2316 essentially. There's some other slight differences, but I look at that and I go, it doesn't actually change the numbers. The numbers in Texas, the abortion numbers have actually gone up. And so while it may seem like it doesn't make sense, I would point back to like economic law. It doesn't make any sense on paper that me giving 10%, my first 10% to God in a tithe would end up being for my financial benefit.
Yeah.
But yet it seems over and over and over that it does. I would go and say the same thing is holding to that principle and saying, you know what, I'm going to stick with justice and agree with God because God's the author, not just of moral law, but the laws of nature. And so his laws are going to be coherent together. And so I do think it ends up working out.
So is there room then in the abolitionist sphere? Is there room for people say, let's go down a hypothetical again. So I support 2316. I go ahead and vote for 2332. If it came before the, on the House, I vote for that. Even though that that's of course, you know, you've made that clear that that's a iniquitous decree. Is there room for somebody that still pleases God and has a right relationship between God and still voting for that 2332?
So I would say that in that moment when they vote for that, I do think that it's an iniquitous decree. So I would say that they've sinned, on that. Does that mean that they're completely, you know, not in right standing with God? Well, certainly on that vote, I would say they were in right standing with God. But I wouldn't say that that necessarily means that you're not a Christian or something like that. I do think that there are brothers and sisters on, you know, on the other side as well. And I would say too, you know, there are some people at this point too, who don't know the difference, just want to come out and trying to do the right thing. And this is what they've been taught. I think that they still should repent from that, of turning from it, but I wouldn't come out here and beat them over a head or something like that on that.
Because I kind of see that as a, that hypothetical would be similar to like, an Asa or a Jehoshaphat in the Old Testament that says, you know, at the end of it, hey, they were a godly king. They pleased the Lord. They didn't remove the high places. Kind of a scenario. So it's a, there's a lot of really good decisions made. They might've made a very, you know, poor decision in one instance, but at the same time, in the grand scheme of their standing between them and God, God looks upon them and smiles. So, because that's one of the things I will say, and I'll try to word this in an appropriate way. Some of the comments and such that have come across have came across the episodes and such from the abolitionist perspective is not that, and so I think that, you know, in the conversation with John Dunwell, there was a, you know, is there any space for Christian brothers on the other side? And I'll give my thoughts on it, and then I want to kind of probe what you're thinking about it. Part of me thinks it's, you know, that maybe some of those individuals that have that perspective on it, they're heartbroken by what happened at this past legislative session, you know, and they're in that almost that anger response of going, I can't believe you've let me down. And then because we're all human, there is that level of lashing out. I've done it many times over in my life and had to get on my knees before God and say, I'm sorry, God. And then had to go apologize to them as well about, you know, I get hurt and then it's just a lash out. And so, but I would say if there's recommendations and such from like both sides, definitely that comes across as a impediment. So I'll say this. There's been some abolitionists, this will suffice it. There's been some abolitionists that make me not want to talk to any any abolitionist. And there's been other abolitionists that I'm like, I really want to get to know their thoughts a little bit more. So Jeremy Danowitz is one of them that like every interaction I've had with him, I'm like, I want to get to know that guy a little bit more. Zach Deacon, yourself. Then there's been others that I'm just like, okay, I'm done with the conversation. And it just doesn't seem that there's Christian grace there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It does make sense. And I think a lot of times kind of what's happening in that moment is that abolitionists, and I don't think this is wrong necessarily. Obviously they're, like you said, I mean, I've talked out in anger before. I've said things anger in a sinful way. There's obviously godly anger. Unrighteous anger, but, you know, I've had to apologize to my children and my wife more than once, you know, kind of a thing.
Same.
Yeah. But I look at it and I go, I think that a lot of times abolitionists are putting on a prophetic role, and there's no doubt. I mean, we're talking about, baby murder, and, one of the things that comes out is that it's like, And this is a tough one. I've gotten blocked before, and not because I don't think I was rightly blocked on Facebook. There are times where I have been rightly blocked, but, but I've gotten blocked by a legislator one time because, and this was several years ago, but it was some kind of, animal cruelty. They did another kind of similar thing this year where it was like strengthening the animal cruelty. And it's like, we get done with the session and it's, hey, we did such a great job. We did this and this and this, you know, animal cruelty. We moved the speed limit from 55 to 60 miles an hour. And I'm like, hey, I don't think people should be cruel to animals. I like driving 60 more than 55, but in comparison,
why are we focusing on these?
Right. And I mean, we've had, the trifecta in Iowa. Yes. The Republicans have controlled the House, the Senate, and the governorship for, I believe, 10 years. We have all Supreme Court justices that are nominated by Republicans. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't get more red than this. I mean, Texas looks at us and they blush at how red we are. You know, I mean, we are an epicenter of red. If voting Republican alone was going to abolish abortion, we would have done that 5 years ago. Yes. And so I do look at that and I go, I think there does need to be a prophetic voice. And I do think what we need to come together as a Christian coalition, and truly come out and say, I certainly support lower property tax. Actually, I support abolishing property taxes. You know, I was going to say lower, but really I support abolishing them. You know, that's, we can get into all these kinds of things, but I'm not going to help you in your effort or praise you in your effort to do anything until we take care of the child sacrifice. You know, in Amos chapter two, Amos chapter one, the children of Ammon, it says that, you know, that they were judged because they were ripping open the stomachs of pregnant women. Well, that's what we're doing with abortion. It's literally nations get judged because of abortion. God has gotten so mad at nations before because of abortion, he's wiped them off the face of the earth. And so I do think it is one of those things of certainly, you know, people can say wrong things. I've said wrong things. I've done that. But I think that sometimes the heat that people feel and hear is just a prophetic voice of going and saying, we need to focus in on something that actually matters.
Yeah. Yeah. And to that point, it was interesting. I got advice one time from a gentleman that I have tremendous amount of respect for. And I was asking questions regarding some people that had taken some certain stands that I didn't agree with. And I mean, they were just, it was intense stands, not political. And he had mentioned, he said, you know, Max, he said, it's important to realize that there's certain people that God uses for certain times. So he's like, John the Baptist was used of God. That's not to say that everybody that God used should walk around in camel skins and, you know, eat locusts and wild honey. And so Joseph was used of God. But like, if you were to flip those roles and say, you know, John the Baptist had a coat of many colors, it just, you know, maybe it wouldn't have fit that scenario. And so God, in his sovereign wisdom, and in his will, he decided to use certain people that might be, you know, the John the Baptist of this world versus the Josephs of this world, all to advance his kingdom and his will.
Yeah. And to get to the point where I'm at, I definitely needed, like I said, it was Tom Hoefling. Wasn't, nice is not a word that I would use to describe what his message was to me. But I would say that was the message I needed because it's what got me thinking, on it for about 2 weeks. And I did go back to him and I apologize for the smart aleck thing that I said back to him and repented of that. And so I think you're exactly right. God does use different people in different ways at different times.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other question that I've got, so abolitionists, you had mentioned earlier that abolitionists don't want specific carve outs for the mothers.
Mm-hmm.
I had a conversation with Maggie DeWitty recently, and from that conversation, some individuals reached out to me, and we were talking about it. And it was, well, of course, Maggie supports abortion, and it just, that took me by surprise because I'm just like, how can she support abortion? She's clearly, you know, opposed to it. And the response was, well, she supports exemptions for the mother. So then it's like, well, clearly she doesn't support abortion. She might, you know, agree with the exemptions of the mother in the prosecution piece, but clearly she doesn't support abortion. And so there was just that level of like, you know, we definitely, it drove some conversation there. So why do abolitionists treat the prosecution of the mother as a non-negotiable, like right now, and not maybe something that would come immediately following? So say if you were to just, and I'm speaking hypothetically, but if there was a bill that said, mm-hmm. We recognize from, I would say conception, but even that's getting gray, from fertilization to mm-hmm. natural death, it's murder. And there was a bill that just said that, without necessarily having all the prosecution language to go after the people that commit those abortions, and just says, hey, it's murder. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm a little confused as to why the abolitionist perspective is that the prosecution of the mother has to come at the same time that we ban abortions. So if you could shed some light on that and maybe clarify my thoughts on that.
Yeah. So, and just so you know, your screen went black. Just
oh, okay.
So you're aware of that. So the concept of just to clarify, so you're talking about like a bill that would the bill that you're saying would have a carve out for the mother, or it just wouldn't?
No, it would
say anything about it.
It just wouldn't say anything about it. It wouldn't have any sort of prosecution language. It would just say, hey, from fertilization in the state, you can't commit an abortion. From any method.
Yeah. So that's a very interesting one. Cause that's, I'm trying to think here what the year was. It was Representative Steve Holtz freshman year, because he actually, he co-sponsored a bill that did exactly that. And it said
really?
That it's yeah, very short bill. And I've talked about that. I haven't seen an abolitionist that would be against, that bill that I'm aware of. Now, because obviously what it's saying is essentially just abortion is murder. And so it would be equal weights. It would be equal measures. Now you look at an abolitionist bill today, 2316, there's going to be a lot more that's in there. And some of it is to preempt, some of the arguments that come back. So it's, I think it's a lot of to use it in the right way, I guess, an evolution of kind of what had happened, from those types of bills. So, like one of the things I believe in 2316, if I'm remembering right, is it talks about how a miscarriage isn't an abortion. So it clarifies that. And then it specifically does go and say that basically that the mother isn't exempt. It doesn't say mother in there. I don't think it says the word mother, but that's essentially what the language is, is that there's
all parties. Yeah.
Right. And, I think the reason why we need to have that, and there's kind of some irony here, is because one of the things that the pro-life movement, does constantly says is that the culture isn't ready for an abolition bill. And part of the reason they're not ready for it, the culture is not ready for it. If you're going now, I think that laws change culture. But
yes, I agree.
Part of the reason why the culture is not ready for it is because the pro-life movement has spent so much time trying to win the mothers over by saying that they are a second victim. It's actually part of the reason I think abolition bills put that in there specifically is to combat against the bad conditioning that the pro-life movement has done.
So from a hypothetical standpoint, you would say that would be one of those, if I could use the term, areas of compromise that the pro-life movement and the abolitionists could come together and just say, hey, from fertilization to natural death, you can't kill that. But because of all of the legal implications to it, from the practical standpoint, of course, that really can't happen, because ultimately then you're going to have, like you say, well, what about miscarriages? What about this case? What about that case? And, you know, well, what about this person that committed it? Are they legally held? Or is the taxi driver that drove the woman? You know, it's... So then you would have to clearly say who it's applied to. So from a hypothetical, we would agree on all that. But from a practical standpoint, it's not feasible to have a bill that's that generic.
Yeah, well, and so while lobbying down at the state house, actually one of the things that we did was, and I work, you know, really close with Representative Zach Deacon. I think he'd be okay with me sharing the story. If not, I apologize, Representative Deacon. But we went around and we talked to other legislators. And one of the things that we did was we had that bill that said exactly what you're saying, you know, that abortion is murder. And we had his bill there and we would present it to legislators and we would say, can you show us what the difference is? And they would say, do you see who co-sponsored this? It's Representative Steve Holt. And we would go and say, I know that a big reason why you might not want to co-sponsor my bill is because Representative Holt, the first year that Representative Deacon put it out, Representative Holt got really mad at abolitionists, probably me in particular, and made some public statements that were kind of wild. I thought, like, I will never support a bill that prosecutes a mother, that would allow for the prosecution of a mother. And so we would go and show it to legislators and we would say, what is the difference? What is the difference if this is actually played out? And then this one we got several co-sponsors that way because people would look at it and they would say, oh, yeah, I can't really tell you what the difference is on that.
Yeah. 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 And that's one of the interesting things. So, I did a episode a while back on Representative Holt's response to the Abolitionist Rising conference that was done here in Des Moines. And they're definitely, and I'll be honest, I didn't even know the Abolitionist Rising group at all. I didn't even know they were a thing. It was just more of a, everybody's pro-life, everybody wants to end abortion. Of course. You know, that's what we've always said. And then I saw some of those signs, and I actually saw it on a reel, Facebook reel from somebody here in Des Moines ripping the signs down. And then I saw a Facebook reel of I think the guy was at Smokey Row. He's with T. Russell Hunter. But anyway, because I've seen his since I've known about him a little bit more, I've seen some more videos and such. And anyway. That's what turned me on to what was going on about the Abolitionist Rising. I'm like, oh, I had no clue this was even going on. And then when Representative Holt made that response of just, you know, and the comments in it, and I hope I'm not misrepresenting it, but essentially it was how nasty the abolitionists were from the conference. And, you know, I can't support these bills. And then he made a comment that it completely blew my mind. He said, we in the pro-life movement, because 2316 didn't have carve-outs for IVF, so IVF would have been banned, which would have been a tremendous thing. And he said, we in the pro-life movement, because we believe life begins at conception, we support IVF. And I was sitting there and I'm scratching my head because I'm like, well, there is a fertilized embryo as a result of IVF. And I did a whole response on that. And then he made the comments about no pro-life organization supported 2316, none. And so I did some digging around, and which was kind of telling that I'm like, okay, the abolitionists, they're not pro-life. That's interesting. I mean, I'm pretty sure they fight for life. Again, not knowing much about them. And I'm just, I'm pretty sure they are, but by implication saying no pro-life organization supported this, you're saying they're not pro-life. So I looked at the legislative website where you can like look at the lobbyists, and I was surprised actually to see Iowa Right for Life had lobbied in favor of that bill, had registered in favor. And you can go out on the legislative website and see that. And it just blew my mind because I'm like, okay, now, I mean, to the letter of the law, and I respect Representative Holt on a bunch of other topics, but that was a lie because clearly even if you wanted to a degree, if you didn't like the abolitionists, didn't want to say that they supported this bill, Iowa Right to Life registered in favor of it. So to say no pro-life organization here in the state voted in favor of it or supported it is just not true. And so that really threw me, Representative Holt's comments on that.
Yeah. And, you know, so a couple of things on this, because just to give you a little history of kind of what the abolition bill in Iowa over the last 3 years, I will just say this too, for some of the old timers that might be watching. Tom Shaw did put an abolition bill. I think that was like maybe around 2010, way back when. And then Hartzell had some bills that would have been effectively abolition bills as well. And so there actually is a history of Iowa with abolition, which is interesting because it's more these last 3 years that it's really kind of caught on. But 3 years ago, so Representative Deacon put forth House File 2256, and actually like all the pro-life organizations supported it initially, minus the family leader. They didn't register on the bill. The Iowa Faith and Family Freedom Coalition was in favor of it. Pulse Life Iowa was in favor of it. Iowa Right to Life. There were a couple Catholic groups that were in favor of it, and they registered in support of the bill. And then what ended up happening was, and I'm just going to give the timeline because I don't want to put the reason as to why, but the timeline is that Representative Holt is getting a lot of pressure. His district may have been canvassed and things of that nature, saying, you know, encourage Representative Holt to move forth House File 2256. And he comes out and does a Facebook Live where he just eviscerates the abolition movement and everything like that. And then the next morning, it was sometime in the middle of the night or really early in the morning, we find out that all of the pro-life organizations that had registered in favor of it had registered neutral on the bill.
Really?
And then things like Pulse Life Iowa came out with a blog post later on explaining why they do not support abolition bills. And Iowa Faith and Faith and Family, Steve Scheffler's group, Faith and Family Freedom. They came out and actually registered opposed to House File 2256. House File 453, which was the next year, I believe Iowa Right to Life did register in favor of it. Again, they supported it, and they supported it, registered in support of it once again for 2316. And so I haven't had a conversation with the person who registered on that in favor of it, but you know, we try to every year go and say, you know, we appreciate those who registered in favor of it and put a Facebook post out. What was disappointing with Representative Holt and going and talking bad about abolitionists is I spent time personally praying with Representative Holt over this. You know, there weren't people who were screaming and yelling at him, anything like that. There were the only screams that happened were we did a chanting match against the LGBTQ mafia while they were there. We kind of went back and forth because, you know, they were like separation of church and state. We were like justice and justice alone.
Yeah.
And we kind of came back afterwards. We're like, we probably shouldn't have done that. But, hopefully we didn't ruin too much of our testimony by chanting at the, the Rainbow Jihad. But but we spent most of our time singing hymns down in the state capitol.
I saw some of the videos. It's beautiful.
Yeah, that's one of the greatest places to go sing hymns. More people should sing hymns down at the state capitol. So
yeah, I agree. Yeah, I was down at the Capitol. When was it? When the civil rights stuff was going on? When they were removing all the LGBT stuff from the civil rights code? Man, that was a wild ride. I got called a fascist, and I hadn't even talked. I just showed up, and I was a fascist. Yeah. And anyway, I went to a subcommittee. Went to talk at a bill, and then I didn't even get a chance to talk. And when I walked out, I'm walking through the entire crowd, and there was a guy that literally, like, I mean, he was 2 inches from my face, and I could feel the spit as he's screaming at me on my face. You know, he just feels the spit right there. And anyway, the Lord gave me the grace to just continue walking. I'm like, I gotta retain a Christian testimony here, but I definitely didn't appreciate having the spit on the face. That's for darn sure. It definitely gets interesting down at the Capitol. So I know that we had talked briefly about the black market pill and about what the authority is on it and why it went to the Appropriations Committee. It was kind of a weird runaround this year. So go ahead and talk about that as far as how did that even come about? Why did it go through the Appropriations Committee? Why was it so late? And why are we saying that it's such a victory when it's pretty much been stripped of any power?
Yeah. So first of all, the black market pill bill, it really doesn't do anything. First of all, anything that would have even potentially been good in it. And like I said, I still don't think it would have been it would have been an iniquitous decree anyway, but the things that would have been good about it, the good aspects, most of those, like the reporting and whatnot, those were stripped out of it before it got passed. And then, okay, so really the only thing it does is if you're ordering a pill from Iowa in Iowa, you have to have an in-person doctor's visit for. Now, I don't know how they're going to enforce that, but that would be it. But most people would just get on their Planned Parenthood app and order it there, and they're going to ship it from out of state, and you're going to have it. There's no jurisdiction. So I mean, the workaround is really, really easy there on that. So it, you know, there's not much, but it was interesting where this bill kind of took off from and where it went from. So it starts off, and I believe it started off in the Judiciary Committee, if I recall correctly. That's where it's at. That would at least make sense, is that's where it should be.
Yeah.
And so it's going through that way. And Jacob Hall from the Iowa Standard actually reported on this, that Representative Deacon comes out and he essentially kills the bill. And how he killed it was he amended it with the abolition bill. He goes and says, look, let's, if we're going to vote on this, we're just going to put the abolition bill on it.
Yeah. And I love that.
So you know, if people are going and saying, like, well, the abolition bill, or that the pill bill, it took a strange route, well, it got killed. that's really what happened. Now, Representative Deacon is one of the most godly men that I know. And he takes, you know, that verse in the Bible serious, that if you don't provide for your family, you're worse than an infidel.
Yep.
And so he made it clear to the caucus. He's made it clear to anybody who would talk to him, his constituents, anybody, that once the session is over, once the days are fulfilled in there, he's going to go back to work because he's going to provide for his family. You know, a lot of times he's a state trooper. So he's a state trooper is his other job. A lot of times the legislature, those who are there are a lot of times older gentlemen who have retired, or if you're generally a lawyer or you're generally a farmer, and you're able to be there for a little bit longer and things of that nature. That's not everybody, but that's a lot of the people. But Representative Deacon's just a working man. And so he was going, I'm going to go and provide for my family. I'm not saying that they were avoiding Representative Deacon, but it was held in Appropriations Committee until after that date. And then it went through, and then it was double barrel amended with pro-life amendments so that nobody could put another abolition amendment on there. But it seems like there may have been some gamesmanship that was happening.
Had by chance come in, he still wouldn't have been able to amend because they jammed it full of other amendments.
That's right. That's right. So he wouldn't have been able to amend it. Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah. So that, you know, when people talk about it's a miracle that it got passed, well, was it a miracle or was it conniving? Well, I think it's probably more conniving than a miracle.
Yeah. Yeah. I was from the explanation you gave, I love the amending it to put the abolitionist bill on it. That takes guts, and it's kind of a comedic act too. Like I appreciate humor like that. I'm a sarcastic individual by nature, and I just find that hilarious, you know. But
well, and what would have happened if they would have actually, you know, progressed it after it got the amendment on it, is that most likely what would have happened is that Speaker Grassley probably wouldn't have brought it up on the floor, House floor.
It's probably what would have not. Happened. Yeah.
But if you would have, you know, progressed, it would have forced the Republicans to vote on it,
which I
think is so important. And I try to push people on this. We don't force the vote. Well, before I became an abolitionist, I was pushing for abolitionist bills, you know, the complete and total abolishment of abortion. I just wasn't an abolitionist yet. You know, I didn't even know that abolitionists existed, maybe. But I still just knew abortion was wrong. it's, I've been pushing for, you know, for abolishing abortion for about 10 years in the, with the legislature, sending out emails, all this kind of stuff, and talking to legislators. And I'm going, you run into this problem of people constantly say the same thing. We don't have the votes. And then I tell them, I go, well, then we should like, tell me who, because we have enough Republicans. Yeah. Like we have a supermajority. You know, one away from a supermajority in the Senate, supermajority in the House. And I'm going, we should
know.
Tell people who they are. Like we shouldn't be protecting these people, because ultimately when we're protecting them, we're they're campaigning on the lives of children is ultimately what they're doing. And
they keep saying, send me back. And they have no intention of actually making good on the promises on their campaign trail.
Right. And it's always, it's these other people who are stopping it. Nobody ever goes and says, it's me who's stopping it. Well, well, you know, something should be happening here. But the other thing is Leviticus chapter 20 tells us that God commands Israel, says, you know, don't have, don't worship Moloch. Don't give your children to Moloch. Yep. Don't kill them. And then he goes and he says that those who allow it, that turn their face away from the Moloch worship, I'm going to set my face against you, turn their eyes away. I'm going to set my face against you, says God. And I have to look at that and I'm going, do you think God is setting his face against us when we refuse to make people vote on it? Because then we're kind of looking, turning our eyes away from those who would prolong Moloch worship or child sacrifice.
Yeah, I think you've got a good point, because, you know, that text is essentially not just the people that do it, but the people that ignore it happening. You know, they're following along with God's judgment on that. They're going to be in that same category of God's judgment. And I think you bring up a valid point on that, that whenever we don't force that vote, and I asked Representative Dunwell how many votes we did have. And I was surprised to hear that we only had, he said, high 40s that would actually vote, even for House File 2332. I mean, I would anticipate less votes on 2316, but I would anticipate an overwhelming majority of the Republicans supporting 2332, at least. And even he said that it was only in the high 40s. So, I mean, we have 30 Republicans in the Iowa House that wouldn't vote even for 2332, and we're not forcing their vote, and they can continue to go campaign. That just, that was a part of that interview that it was eye-opening to me how few of people we actually had that would stand for life.
Yeah, well, and you know, Max, on that, I think that probably goes to show you that the black market pill bill really doesn't do anything, because what's the big difference here? If the black market pill bill really is stopping 60% of abortions, if that's what it's intended to do, you're telling me that these 30 are like, you know, my line in the sand is that you can't get your pills, through the mail. You have to see a doctor first. That's really where my line in the sand is. I don't think that's the case at all. I think that they all know that pill bill did nothing. And it was just a reason to go and slap themselves on the back.
Yeah. So Representative Dunwell in a Facebook post just, I mean, he put it out and got a lot of flack for it. I think there potentially was some misunderstandings. I really wish I could have asked John Dunwell some more questions on that Facebook post, but we had an agreed upon time, and I was right at that, you know, knocking on the door of that agreed time. But one of the things that I was able to ask, and I hope that you had had a chance to look at it, was the position. Essentially, he seemed to have pitted the gospel against abolitionist bills, saying that if we prosecute the mother, then somehow the abolitionist bill would cause a woman to not come to her pastor and confess the sin and gain repentance. And there was a comment that he said in that Facebook post that we're to come boldly before the throne of grace, and the abolitionist bill would impede that. To which, you're a pastor, and his main claim was it's a pastoral problem. And then very much a pitting the gospel. I mean, there was definitely a position in that statement that he made that was, if you believe the abolitionist bill is correct, then you are now standing in between a woman and her forgiveness with God. And so I guess I'll kind of ask you in a sarcastic manner, but why are you so anti-gospel?
Yeah. So it's really funny because when I was reading that he said this, because literally, so I go out and I hold signs. You know, I'm one of those abolitionists. I literally go out and I hold signs. Was just kicked out of the Quad Cities or Farmers Market last week weekend.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. And but one of the signs that I hold, one of the signs I hold most often, it's my favorite sign, is that it says abortion is murder and forgiveness for murder can be found in Jesus Christ alone. Mm,
amen.
You know, it's been my experience, because I do have, I've had people come to me who have murdered their child in the womb, that in other horrific acts as well. You know, as a pastor, you're counseling all these kinds of things. And I have never had success by excusing someone's sin. I've only ever had success seeing repentance by holding up the law of God and saying, this is where you did wrong. There is forgiveness of this. There is also consequences because you did this thing that's wrong. But, you know, there's earthly consequences. But I go, but this is God's standard. And, you know, Psalm 19:7 says the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. I don't think it gets more clear than this. It's not that the law saves, but it is that when people see the standard of God's law, they see where they have fallen short.
Yes.
And then they cry out for grace. I don't think that grace and law are pitted against one another. I think they work hand in hand, because grace is a gift that God gives because we've fallen at the law. What I think John Dunwell, Representative Dunwell, wants to do is he wants to have that grace without the standard, which doesn't make any sense, because First John tells us that sin is transgression against the law. And if you need to be saved from your sin, then that means you have had to have seen that you've transgressed against the law. So there is no grace unless there is law that's been established, or there is no need for grace. So if we remove that law, well, then we didn't need grace to begin with, because then we're all of a sudden meeting the standard. So I would say actually his philosophy when it comes to dealing with abortion is more of an impediment to the gospel, whereas then I would say that an abolitionist view is not an impediment at all, but it actually it bolsters the gospel. It allows us to put the gospel on the pedestal so that people can all look to it and see it. You know, another thing in there, just to kind of throw this one out here, not to cut you off, but to cut you off, I guess that's what I'm doing, right? it seems as though, because he's very much, he brought out the word compassion and mercy several times. And I do think, you know, certainly, you know, Micah 6:8 tells us that that what is our responsibility, what is our duty, oh man, it is to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. Well, I think that order is very important, because justice must precede mercy, because when we try to give mercy without an establishment of justice, it ends up becoming an enablement of sin or a false compassion. And really mercy. So if grace is getting a gift we don't deserve, mercy is, having something held back that we do deserve. What mercy
is. Good.
And so justice being established. So, I would say that under the pro-life laws that we have, especially when there's a carve out for the mother, the mother can never receive mercy legally, because she never has to face what she's done legally. Mm. And so she's not now, obviously she can be saved. I'm not saying she can't receive mercy from God in salvation, but legally she can't be shown mercy. There's not even an opportunity. The only thing that gives that opportunity is an abolitionist bill. And once again, if we're going to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God, we have to have that justice established first.
Yeah. So just to be clear, then, the abolitionist bill, in refuting that claim, the abolitionist bill does nothing that stands between a woman and God, gaining forgiveness with God?
No. In fact, I think it draws women closer to God. Absolutely. Yeah.
Amen. Well, Sam, I really appreciate you joining me for the conversation tonight. I definitely think that it's been an important discussion. I think there's been some misappropriations made about abolitionists that, you know, according to Steve Holt, they're all nasty, apparently. And I've had a very pleasant conversation tonight. So thank you for that, Sam.
Well, thank you so much for having me on, Max. And yeah, I keep looking for those nasty abolitionists, but I just can't find them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I appreciate the wonderful conversation we've had. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.